The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Thomas M. Harris presiding.
Good afternoon. This is case number 4-22-0669, Thomas Nord versus Residential Alternatives of Illinois et al. Counsel, could you state your appearances for the record?
Donna Fudge for the defendants.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Amanda Hamilton, and I represent the plaintiff appellee in this matter.
All right, very good. Thank you. Ms. Fudge, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
You may.
May it please the court. I want to begin with the three things that the trial court did right in this case before they made their error. First, the trial court was correct on the issue of contract formation in concluding that there was a making of an agreement to arbitrate. Second, the court was correct in concluding that that subject arbitration agreement is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act. And third, the court was correct in recognizing that the arbitration agreement contained a delegation clause via the incorporation of the AAA rules. In fact, the court even cited verbatim Rule 7 of the AAA rules. But then the court made its error. And that error was failing to appreciate that the state never made a challenge specifically directed to that delegation clause. And therefore, the court was left with no choice but to find the delegation clause valid and enforce it under sections 2 and 3 of the FAA.
Counsel, I have a question. The first sentence of the contract, which is titled term, states that the contract terminates, quote, the day the resident is discharged, unquote. Do you dispute that Naomi was discharged upon her death on December 15, 2018?
Well, no, not the way the word discharge is used in the nursing home context, Your Honor. In fact, she remained at the nursing home until her death. So it wasn't like she was discharged out to home or to a hospital or to another nursing home and died there. She remained at my client's nursing home, and therefore she was not discharged.
So that term of the contract doesn't apply, that it remains, contract terminates, rather, the date the resident is discharged, even when she died, the contract didn't terminate?
I think that's correct. And I also think we have to remember that the estate belatedly made this argument about termination, number one, and this court, with all due respect, is without jurisdiction to even engage in this issue of the termination argument, because number one, under the Buckeye rule, the estate is using this termination argument as an attack on the enforceability of the contract as a whole. And we know from Buckeye that attacks on the contract as a whole must be left to the arbitrator. Secondly, our agreement that we are seeking to compel is the delegation clause that was not specifically attacked, and therefore it's valid and enforceable. And under our delegation clause, all issues about the enforceability of this contract must be left to the arbitrator.
Counsel, I just want to ask you specifically about something you just said. You said that we're without jurisdiction to address these matters. What do you mean?
What I mean is that this agreement was correctly found to be under the FAA. That means that the Federal Arbitration Act's entire federal substantive body of law on the issue of arbitrability applies in this court as a state court with equal force as if it would if we were a federal court. And therefore, under that FAA body of law, once my client moved to compel under the delegation clause, and the court found that there was the making of the agreement under the FAA with that delegation clause, and the estate failed to make a specific attack on the delegation clause, under Rent-A-Center and Henry Schein, the court's work was done. The court was mandated at that moment to respect the delegation clause and to enforce the delegation clause.
But there wouldn't be anything from a jurisdictional standpoint preventing us on appeal from adopting the appellee's argument that termination of the contract terminated the arbitration agreement as well. from a jurisdictional standpoint. Is that correct?
I disagree with you, because under Rent-A-Center, when Mr. Jackson failed to make an attack on the delegation clause specifically, the United States Supreme Court was very clear. That was a fatal mistake by Mr. Jackson. It was too late for Mr. Jackson to raise that challenge at the appellate level. His failure to attack the delegation clause at the trial court level left the court with one choice and one choice only. The United States Supreme Court said, number one, the court must find the delegation clause valid under Section 2 of the FAA, and it must enforce it under Sections 3 and 4 of the FAA and compel the case to arbitration. I think this court is left with no other choice but that. And that means that this court does not have jurisdiction to engage in this argument of termination.
Is the arbitration provision a separate contract or an addendum to the contract that the parties entered into?
It is an addendum, sir.
Is the arbitration provision contains no language stating it survives the termination of the contract, does it?
It is silent on whether or when it might terminate, correct?
Well, is there any reason to believe that, assuming that the death of Naomi amounts to a discharge, and I don't know how it could be disputed, then why doesn't that mean that the contract and all its provisions terminated at that point as well?
Well, I guess logically you'd have to die first and then be discharged. I mean, even if it's just a few moments in between the two, which means that at the moment of death, you're not discharged yet. So that's just kind of a logical argument I would make. And I also want to make it clear that—
So death doesn't constitute a discharge under the contract?
Well, again, we're engaging in interpretation of the contract. And we have to keep in mind, even when we don't have a delegation clause, your decision in Mason, the Illinois Supreme Court decision in Donaldson v. Barr says, even without a delegation clause, contract interpretation must be left to the arbitrator. So we should not even be—
Let's assume for the moment we disagree and respond to the questions I'm specifically asking. And the question is specifically, can the arbitration provision survive the termination of this contract without any language saying it will survive the term? It could have been put in, but it wasn't. So absent that language, does this arbitration language survive the termination of the contract?
It does, yes. And the reason is, we cited to the case of Litton, which is a United States Supreme Court 1991 case that recognizes that the duty to arbitrate under a contract survives the death of one of the parties. And that makes common sense as well. And that's particularly true where you're dealing with a contract like this that is not a personal service contract. So under our type of contract, yes, the arbitration agreement can and does survive the death of the resident.
Well, your client wrote the contract. This is essentially an adhesion contract. Why shouldn't any uncertainties about how it should be viewed in a light most favorable to the patient and against your client?
I think we're getting a little bit into the issue of a scope. You know, does the scope of this arbitration agreement include her fall and fracture that happened while she was alive? And does it include issues that happened up until the death? And that is a scope debate. And under the FAA, Federal Substantive Law of Arbitrability, again, under our delegation clause, scope is to be left to the arbitrator. But even if it weren't, all doubts, and I stress all doubts, regarding the scope of an arbitration agreement are to be resolved in favor of finding arbitrability and not against.
And counsel, in that regard, and I know there's citation to case law that we got to be careful about creatively using terms to differentiate between the creation of the contract versus the validity of the contract, but the existence of the contract. I want to use that word very carefully here, the existence of the contract. Are we talking about the existence of the arbitration agreement? Assuming that the contract terminated, and I'm talking about the nursing home contract terminated at the time of death, did the arbitration agreement no longer continue to exist at that point? So that, you know, and now we're talking about this being an issue for the court to decide versus an issue for the arbitrator to decide.
So first, keep in mind that we moved to compel just under the delegation clause. And yes, there is an existence of that delegation clause, which under the severability rule of Buckeye stands on its own. That delegation clause is its own agreement to arbitrate. So you're right, you shouldn't be looking at the underlying admission contract and what it says about termination. The eyes of the court should be focused on the delegation clause. The delegation clause says nothing about how long it remains in place, when it terminates, if it ever terminates. And for those reasons, I think that this entire case needs to be compelled into arbitration.
Counsel, I'm sure you're familiar with the recent decision of the First District in Clanton versus Oak Brook Healthcare, in which the court there held that the essentially the same sort of issue we have here, that the arbitration provision was part of the contract and the contract terminated on the death of the decedent. Why shouldn't this court follow Clanton?
First, Clanton, although it did incorporate the JAMS rules, which the JAMS rules do have a delegation clause, I want to make this point. Nobody in the Clanton court in that case ever asked that the delegation clause be triggered. My client has asked that the delegation clause be triggered. So that alone distinguishes our case from Clanton. Also, our arbitration agreement is an addendum to the underlying admission contract. In Clanton, it was part of the contract.
I was just going to ask to pause a second. Why should that make a difference? I mean, don't we have to read both of them together? The addendum and the contract?
Well, with all due respect, no, because again, once there's the making of an agreement to arbitrate with a delegation clause, and that delegation clause has not been challenged specifically by the estate, we shouldn't be engaging in any sort of interpretation here and construction of the underlying agreement with the arbitration agreement. And the other point I want to make is that in Clanton, there's another distinguishing fact. In Clanton, the contract said that it terminated on the death of that resident. Our underlying contract says that it ends or it terms at discharge. Those are two different words, death and discharge.
Well, that's my first question that I asked you, counsel. Do you dispute that when she died, she was discharged within the meaning of this contract?
And I think I, logically to me, if I die right now, you haven't discharged my body yet. I'm still in my bed, for example, that I have passed away in. So with all due respect, I do think there's a distinction between the moment of death and once your body is discharged from the nursing home facility.
Andres Bardellis is the administrator of the Manor Court, is she not?
Yes, it's a gentleman, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, there's an affidavit that he provided attached to Manor Court's motion to compel arbitration, in which he says in paragraph 2, Naomi Nord was admitted as a resident to Manor Court on October 10, 2016. Ms. Nord remained at Manor Court until she was discharged on December 15, 2018, unquote. That, of course, was the date of her death. Seems to me like the position of your client wasn't involved in these philosophical issues of his discharge, a death, or the likewise, but seem to, or is there some difference, seem to in this affidavit have conceded what is seems to me to be pretty obvious, that when you die, you're discharged within the meaning of the contract.
Well, first, there's no conflict here. This affidavit doesn't mention death. We know from the complaint, which is in your record, that she did die on the 15th. Well, and we know that she died in the nursing home.
The contract term is discharge. It says the contract continues until discharge. And the manager here, Andres Bardelis, said Ms. Nord, paragraph 2, remained in Manor Court until she was discharged on December 15, 2018. It's your exhibit number 1. That's the date she died. So essentially, aren't we in a situation where you're not disputing that she was discharged upon her death on December 15th?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that she died. Yes,
no answer, counsel.
She died, and then her body was removed and discharged from the nursing home. She wasn't discharged and then died, and I think that that's an important sequence.
Your situation is, in your position before the trial court, you did not dispute that she was discharged on December 15, 2018. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, but she died first before she was discharged.
So that means the discharge is of no effect.
Well, her cause of action for wrongful death accrued at the moment of death. So that means that her survival action for when she fell and had her fracture existed while she was still a resident. So it's under the arbitration agreement. And at the moment of death, she was still in the nursing home. And so her wrongful death cause of action accrued while she was still in the nursing home.
So if we view this as her death is the equivalent of discharge, as indeed Mr. Bardella said, do you lose?
I don't think so. I don't see how discharge could precede death. And even if they happened at the same time, the cause of action accrued at that same time. So either way, her negligent survival claim and the wrongful death claim all accrued while she was still a resident, and therefore both claims are.
The issue is whether or not the arbitration provision survives the termination of the contract, isn't it? So there is no question of seconds or minutes. If she dies and that amounts to a discharge, then subsequent to her death and discharge, the contract which calls for arbitration, which was then terminated, no longer applies, does it?
No, incorrect. Under the Litton case, the duty to arbitrate survives the termination of the contract. And again, an arbitration agreement is just another.
Even if the contract provides for no such language, even if you could have put it in saying that the arbitration agreement survives the death of the decedent or discharge?
Yeah, because it's basic contract law that applies here to an arbitration agreement. And in this situation, the arbitration agreement and the delegation clause is silent. So with all due respect, you're trying to write words into a contract that just aren't there. And I don't think regular general contract law allows courts to do that. And it wouldn't allow us to add words to this arbitration agreement, including adding words to the delegation clause that simply aren't there.
If discharge is, if you just assume what Justice Steigman suggested there, that when she died, that was the same as discharge and the contract terminated. Does that make this case just like Mason?
No, it doesn't. Because again, Mason did not have a delegation clause. We have a delegation clause. We have specifically asked that this case be compelled to arbitration under that delegation clause. That
put aside the delegation clause, Mason still found the arbitration agreement to be viable, even with the termination upon death clause, correct?
Yeah, because Mason said the claim accrued before the termination, correct? And that's what I'm trying to say. The negligent survival claim accrued, even if taking your argument about termination, the negligent survival claim and the wrongful death claim necessarily had to have accrued before the alleged termination of the contract.
And Mason, the Mason court followed the Supreme Court decision in Carter. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And are you aware that our Supreme Court granted the PLA in Clanton?
I did just learn that, yes.
Okay. And would the Supreme Court's decision in Clanton affect the issues we have in this case?
Potentially, yes. Although, again, I would like to point out that Clanton did not have a delegation clause. And I hate to keep harping on that.
Well, but aside from that, if you want to put that aside, it did have a termination on death clause, different than the discharge language here, but more similar to the language in Mason, correct?
Correct.
And so the Clanton court came to a different conclusion than Mason. So there are conflicting opinions with regard to the issue of the survivability of the arbitration clause. Isn't that correct?
Yes, I think that's correct.
I'd like to ask my colleagues' indulgence to ask one additional question, if that's okay.
Just
in regards to the delegation clause, what does it, I know Appley's dispute that there actually exists a delegation clause in this arbitration agreement. In your remaining time here, what does the delegation clause say here? And I guess part and parcel is, where is that delegation clause?
The delegation clause is right where the trial court found it. It's in the AAA Rule 7 of the commercial rules, and the court below quoted it verbatim. It delegates all issues regarding the existence, scope, validity, and arbitrability to the arbitrator.
Okay, thank you. And you'll have time in rebuttal, Ms. Fudge. Ms. Hamilton, this is your opportunity to address the court. And if you wouldn't mind, could you just pick up on that last point Ms. Fudge addressed, and that being the existence of a delegation clause?
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you. And may it please the court. With respect to the delegation clause, and I think we set this out pretty thoroughly in our brief, is that it's not quite as clear as counsel states. If you look at the actual contract and the arbitration provision, that two-page document that's solely in italics, and I have it marked, it's at C-254 and 255 in the record. There's nowhere in the contract itself or in the arbitration provision does it say that these parties are clearly and unmistakably agreeing to delegate the issue of arbitrability to the arbitrator. As the Supreme Court said, that is absolutely what's required. They want to make sure that the parties are knowingly and unequivocally agreeing that, hey, if there's any dispute as to whether or not we should be arbitrating, we are together agreeing that that issue should be submitted to the arbitrator. In this case, that just wasn't there. As we cited to our additional authority of Kulusinski, the First District recently rejected that same argument that counsel is making, saying, well, it sort of has a tendency to put the cart before the horse of why would you submit to an arbitrator an issue whether or not something's arbitrable. It really should be, that's the court's job to look at the contract, to apply the law governing contracts made in Illinois, and to then make that decision. So another issue that we pointed out that I found particularly problematic is that the language saying that it was going to be incorporating the, you know, Rule 7 of the arbitration rules. Number one, that's not actually the language that's required by the rules themselves. As we indicated in our brief in pages 18 and 19, the rules say what you're supposed to have in the contract if you want to fully incorporate those rules. And they talk about it's the commercial arbitration rules, not consumer rights arbitration rules or other various arbitration rules. There is no mention in the contract or in the arbitration provision of which set of rules are we referring to or are we incorporating. Not only that, but the rules that the appellant relies on, saying that there's this delegation, weren't actually made effective until October 1 of 2013, whereas the form that they generated and relied on was actually generated 7 years prior to those rules being promulgated and being deemed effective. So given the fact that neither the contract nor the arbitration provision contain the rules that the arbitration rules say they're supposed to have, that disclaimer saying, here's what we're doing, we're incorporating everything. Given the 7 year time lap, and given there's nowhere in there that they're saying, by the way, we're gonna submit the issue of arbitrability to an arbitrator rather than a court in Illinois in Stevenson County where we're all having this dispute. I don't think that there's been clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agreed to delegate this issue to the arbitrator. If that answers your question, Judge, I apologize for the long-winded answer. But more importantly,
so, what is your position with regard to the language of discharge? And is that not equivalent to death of the decedent, so that they're one and the same event, let's say, under this, under the facts here and under the contract?
Justice, I think they're absolutely the same. And as Your Honor pointed out, the Supreme Court did just grant the PLA in the Clanton case a few days ago. As we, in preparing for today's argument, I did notice that. So I would say that in the event that the Illinois Supreme Court decides to follow the reasoning of Clanton as opposed to Mason, I think that's dispositive as to the issue of this whole arbitrability issue, because it would terminate in its entirety. Now, if the Illinois Supreme Court decides to follow Mason and find that the termination of the contract does not necessarily terminate the arbitrability of the causes of action which accrue prior to death, well, then I still think Your Honors can affirm the findings of the trial court based on the issues of procedural substantive unconscionability. That's why we argued for those as alternative bases. Certainly, if the Illinois Supreme Court comes out and says that Clanton is the rule, then we're done here, because everything would terminate in its entirety.
The appellants in their brief, they suggest a scenario that would make it kind of dubious, your position, if we were to follow it to its logical conclusion. And here under this contract, a resident could terminate the agreement with 30 days notice, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And if the resident did that and left owing money to the nursing home, according to your theory, the arbitration agreement would be terminated at that point, correct?
That's correct.
So the nursing home's ability to collect for the past due rent could not be by way of arbitration, because the arbitration agreement would be terminated under your theory.
Certainly, the way that the contract and the arbitration provisions are written, I believe that would be the case, and that they would have to litigate the matter in Stevenson County, just as my client is doing.
So you do agree that that would be the outcome under that scenario?
I do, Justice. I think that that's the way the contract is written. Certainly, there are other ways in which it could have been written that would have allowed for that scenario if they wanted to arbitrate the issue of fees. But as Judge Schorsch, indicated at the trial court level, he was kind of struggling to come up with a situation in which the nursing home is actually going after a resident who is decided to leave and has had unpaid fees, because the nursing home is in a considerably better situation to ensure the payment of those fees. Also given the fact that in this particular scenario, over 75% of the residents were Medicaid recipients and the facility was receiving federal funding, the likelihood of that particular scenario seems to be small, but I would agree with Your Honor, and should that event arise, yes, I believe that the nursing home would be required to file suit in the county.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And the Mason court followed Carter and looked at when the survivability claims accrued, and based on the reasoning in Carter and some of the discussion, came to the conclusion that certainly while the nursing home resident was alive, they were in a position to modify the arbitrability agreement. Isn't that correct, if they wanted to?
That's what the court found, yes, Justice. That's what the court
found. And on that basis, Mason came to the conclusion that it did.
That the arbitrability extended to claims that accrued prior to the resident's death or discharge, yes, that's what the court found. And certainly, if the Illinois Supreme Court follows that same logic, then our argument about death terminating the contract would not be an alternative basis for Your Honors to affirm. Certainly, if the Illinois Supreme Court agrees with Clanton, then I think that's an easy basis to affirm. But we did include that argument, Justice, just as an alternative and additional argument to affirm the trial court's ruling, because if you look through the record here, that's not the only basis. And to your point, Justice Zinoff, you know, finding a resident in a position to negotiate or to somehow alter the arbitrability provisions is really one of the issues that the trial court took issue with in his ruling. And in finding it specifically to be substantively unconscionable under these unique facts and circumstances. You know, the record demonstrates that we have an elderly woman who was being discharged from the hospital. Specifically, the hospital told her son, we can't do anything else for her right now. She's got to go. And right now, this facility is the only place that's responding to the call saying that they have space for her. We've demonstrated on the record that he was presented with all these documents to sign and that it was his understanding that he had to sign all of them in order for his mother to be admitted. There is nowhere in the arbitration provision saying this is not a requirement for admission or.
But the facts counsel show that this was an intelligent man who had a career, who made the choice to put her there. So you're not saying that this was procedurally unconscionable, are you?
I think that there's a basis for that as well, Justice, simply because I think, you know, even the most intelligent people under situations of duress and extreme emotional distress can, you know, maybe not really have an opportunity to fully understand what they're reading or what they're signing. And in this instance,
don't the facts show, I'm sorry to interrupt you, don't the facts show that he was given the documents on the 10th and they weren't signed until the 11th? The date on his next to his signature is the 11th.
I believe some of the documents were signed on the 11th, some were on the 10th, because he was moving his mother in the evening of the 10th, getting her clothes and whatnot. But I think more importantly, Justice, is I think the, you know, we've got several guidelines from the federal government and the federal regulations that we cited in our brief. And from the Nursing Home Care Act itself, where the legislature has been very specific about what it wants to do, how it wants to protect residents, how it wants to encourage nursing home claims to be brought. And if you want to circumvent those things, you have to include certain protections. You have to ensure that residents are being made aware of their rights. And in this instance, I think that the trial court absolutely was correct in finding that by requiring a $1,500 initiation of arbitration fee, whereas the cost to file a complaint in Stevenson County is roughly $300, requiring the resident to bear the costs of paying for the arbitrator's fees and not having any sort of end date in sight.
But are we not looking at this arbitration clause and whether it was, whether there was unconscionability with regard to it? And accordingly, is there information in the record as to what, her finances were? I don't believe there is information. Wasn't the trial court just talking about generally persons of no means without regard to Naomi and her personal finances?
No, the trial court correctly noted that under the Nursing Home Care Act, you're really not supposed to take into account any individual's personal finances. You're just supposed to look at them as a resident of that nursing home. And that was a very nuanced distinction. I think the trial court did a great job of going through that analysis and explaining that, okay, in this instance, we do happen to know what her finances were, but we really shouldn't because those are supposed to be kept confidential. And for purposes of the Nursing Home Care Act, it's irrelevant. And so looking specifically at this arbitration provision, the trial court noted that these terms were unconscionable, the $1,500 fee requiring the resident to incur all the expenses of the arbitrators, having a fee shifting provision, not letting the individual know, by the way, you're waiving your right to a jury trial and an appeal, having to pay your own fees, eliminating that fee shifting provision in favor of the resident, which the Nursing Home Care Act was designed to have that provision just to encourage individuals to bring claims, to encourage attorneys to take claims that they might not otherwise take because of lack of financial attraction, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. And the trial court went through all of that in the record at page 66 through 68, and then again, all the way through 79 through 89, explaining about how the Nursing Home Care Act was designed to do the opposite of what a lot of these arbitration provisions tended to do. And that's why he found it specifically to be unconscionable the way it was written and the way it applied to these residents.
Counsel, isn't there a difference also in this case in Mason with the nature of the arbitration clause, noting that in Mason, the arbitration clause, although not crystal clear, seems to contain some reference to subsequent issues arising between the nursing home and the resident. For instance, the very first sentence, any action dispute, claim, or controversy related to the quality of health care, et cetera, now existing or hereafter arising. That would be arguably a claim post-discharge, post-death of tort action being brought as in this case, and say, well, that's a claim hereafter arising that's subject to arbitration. We don't have anything like that, that language from Mason in this case, do we?
That is absolutely correct, Judge. That language does not exist in the contract or the arbitration provision that the facility prepared.
Ms. Hamilton, again, relating to Mason and Clanton here, opposing counsel, when discussing the accrual rights aspect of the Mason case, she cited to the Litton versus NLRB case at page 4 of the reply brief. And I wanted to ask you, the quote there is that from Litton is, rights which accrued or vested under the agreement will, as a general rule, survive termination of the agreement. So that statement in Litton would seem to support this court's holding in Mason, wouldn't it?
It would, Judge. I would note that Litton was obviously a National Labor Relations Board dispute, so it's certainly factually distinguishable. It also did not deal with the implications of the Illinois-specific Nursing Home Care Act, which I think that is also a compelling factor, given that those are the laws that this court is being faced with, and those were not before the U.S. Supreme Court in Litton. But I would agree that that general precept and that general understanding would support the court's finding in Mason.
I posed a hypothetical earlier to you about the non-payment of rent and termination. I'd like to just switch it so that it's the resident that is terminating, the resident is actually injured, suffers an injury, doesn't die, but suffers an injury, gives 30 days notice to terminate the contract, and then following that, files a suit for personal injuries. And I think you agreed under the prior scenario that the arbitration agreement would be terminated at that point, and the resident in the scenario I just described would be able to sue in state court. Is that right?
That would be my position, certainly, Judge, yes.
The injury that she sustained would have been something that accrued during the term of the agreement as described in Litton, though, right? That would have been an accrued right?
If the resident in your hypothetical sustained an injury and then gave notice that he or she was going to be leaving 30 days later, left, and then wanted to bring suit for the prior injury?
Yes.
Yes, that is correct. It would have accrued prior.
Well, so wouldn't Litton then support the survivability of that arbitration agreement in that scenario?
I would say no, Justice, simply because of the policy implications that I've just discussed, given the Illinois Nursing Home Care Act and the policy that the legislature and these courts have placed upon caring for elderly and our more vulnerable population and giving them the opportunity to exercise their rights to the fullest extent that the law allows. So I would argue no, that that resident would not be bound by an arbitration provision simply because of the termination and because of all the things that we've just discussed, given the protections that the Nursing Home Care Act provides these elderly residents.
Is there any significance to the difference in language in the residency agreements between the one in this case and the one in Clanton? In this case, it says that the term of the contract shall terminate the day the resident is discharged. And in Clanton, it says this contract shall terminate immediately upon the resident's death. And I'm just, the distinction I'm pointing to is in Clanton, it says this contract shall terminate. And in this case, it says the term of the contract shall terminate. Just in terms of that narrow difference, is there any significance?
I don't believe so, Judge. And again, I think as Justice Stigman pointed out, you know, we have an affidavit from the, you know, from the defendant appellant's administrator saying that she was discharged on that same day. So I don't think it's significant whether you have a contract that says it terminates on death or it terminates on discharge like this one. We've already gotten admission from the individual.
And I wasn't being clear, and I'm sorry. I don't mean for you to focus on the discharge being tantamount to death here, but the actual phrasing of the contract, it says the term of the contract shall terminate in this case. And in Clanton, it says this contract shall terminate. And the reason I'm asking this is because Clanton, throughout that decision, stresses the breadth of that statement in the contract. And in paragraph 62, it says, we are simply giving effect to the contract's unequivocal language that all of its provisions terminate upon the resident's death. And I just wanted to find out from your perspective, is there a significance in the difference in the phrasing of the contracts here?
I don't believe so, Judge, and simply, and I want to double check my record because I always like to triple check myself as opposed to relying on my own memory. But I don't believe that the phrasing of term of contract in this particular instance was that different or that significant as it compares to that which was in Clanton. But I can certainly double check that and submit something if Your Honor would like. I see that I'm out of time.
Justice Harris, may I ask a follow-up question to yours, please, but related?
Certainly.
So, but would that answer change depending on whether the addendum was part of the contract? Opposing counsel, we know, argued that the addendum was not part of the contract. And so I think it was clear in Clanton that there probably could be no question that it was actually part of the contract. It wasn't listed as an addendum. Would that make a difference in your answer?
No, Justice, I think that the circumstances that we've set forth, the evidence that's been presented demonstrates that, you know, when you have a set of documents that are all read together, signed together, explained together, these were absolutely all part of the same agreement. They're part of the same transaction. I don't think that you could possibly read them as separate documents in any way, especially given the testimony from the administrator and from the individuals that were involved here. I think that they would have to be read together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Ms. Fudge, a rebuttal argument?
Yes. First of all, regarding the delegation clause issue, again, the estate failed to make any specific attack to that at the trial court level. And under the Rent-A-Center decision, it is too late for the estate to come at this appellate level and try to attack the validity of that delegation clause. I would also add that countless courts throughout the country, both state and federal, from coast to coast, have found similar incorporation of rules like the AAA or JAMS to be clear and unmistakable delegation clauses. I would also argue that this debate over how to interpret the contract as to whether it's the commercial rules or the consumer rules is getting into interpretation issues that should be left to the arbitrator. And whether you look at the commercial rule 7 or the consumer rule 14 of the AAA, they both have the exact same delegation clause.
Counsel, I need some clarification. If I remember correctly, I think the second question I asked you was, do you view the arbitration addendum as part of one contract? Are we talking here about different contracts, namely the initial contract and the arbitration provision as being separate? And I believe you said it's all one contract. Did you not?
So we have the underlying
counsel that calls for a yes or no answer regarding something you said 30 minutes ago.
The arbitration agreement is an addendum to the underlying residency agreement. However, under the FAA federal substantive law.
That wasn't my question. My question was, are you contending that these are two separate contracts, or is the arbitration addendum provision part of the same contract?
It's part of the same contract, but under the severability rule of the FAA in cases like Buckeye, the arbitration agreement is its own separate agreement as well. That it's kind of, they're both concepts. Well, that
have to be- all terms of a contract, their own separate agreements because they're part of the contract?
I didn't hear your question, I'm sorry.
Aren't all terms of a contract agreements because they are part of the contract? I mean, you know, that's a, that seems to be just a, I forget what the term is, but a, we're talking about a contract provision. If it's in the contract, it's a binding provision of the contract, isn't it? And that's what you're saying the arbitration agreement was.
I'm saying the arbitration agreement is a valid binding agreement. And I'm saying that under the FAA federal substantive law of arbitrability, an arbitration agreement is severable from the remainder of the contract in which it is exists. And in our two-page arbitration agreement, the delegation clause, just that sentence, is itself severable and stands on its own.
Is my understanding correct that the nursing home wrote this contract?
I don't know, and it's not in the record.
So you think it was perhaps the patient as she was coming in who wrote the contract that she signed?
I would be speculating. There's no information in the record.
What's your inference, counsel?
Oh, my inference is that the resident herself, Mrs. Nord, did not write or type this agreement.
Sorry. I think that's a good guess. So my question is there any reason why the contract couldn't have been written with regard to the arbitration provision to say the arbitration provision contains no language stating that it survives. Well, the arbitration provision contains language saying it survives the termination of the contract. That would have been an easy sentence to include, wouldn't it?
It could have been included, but it didn't have to be included.
Given that it's essentially an adhesion contract presented by the nursing home to the patient, is there any reason why this absence shouldn't be held against the nursing home?
Lots of reasons. First of all, when you mention adhesion contracts, first, you're talking about a concept of contract enforceability. I'm here trying to explain that we're only supposed to be talking about contract formation. That's the court's jurisdiction. And the court here found the making of an agreement to arbitrate. It found it's under the FAA and it has a delegation clause that went unchallenged. The court's work, with all due respect, is done at that point, and the court should not be delving into issues of enforceability, such as whether there's procedural unconscionability and adhesion contracts, or whether the son Nord really knew what he was doing, just like the court should not be engaging in substantive unconscionability analysis. That is an enforceability issue that has been delegated to the arbitrator. It is so important to understand the distinction, as Justice Harris pointed out, between the existence of this delegation clause on one hand versus whether it continued to be enforceable after the moment it was first made and created. And once we find that it has been made, all questions as to whether it was terminated sometime thereafter are issues solely and only for the arbitrator to hear and decide. This is the concept
Ms.
of-
Ms. Fudge, yeah. I'm sorry, but you may not have noticed you are now out of time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both. The case will be taken under advisement and we will issue a written decision.